You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 2nd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Glenn Greenwald, on the extremism that has been normalized in our daily discourse, in our media, and in our lives. Also on the program today, Mitt Romney's financial mysteries increase. He doubles down on the cultural reasons why Palestinians are not doing well. Apparently that occupation thing get completely embedded into your culture. Also on the program today, well, a lot of other things. Before we go to this first story I want to talk about, a couple of house cleaning notes. A, my house is a mess. B, my wife is freaking out because there's a big chemical fire upstate, apparently. And within a 15-mile radius of, well, somewhere near up in Columbia County, people are being asked to stay in their homes because of a fire that is releasing all sorts of PCBs. Wonderful. Just wonderful. I guess TCI of New York. It's a company that has supposedly been disposing of electrical equipment and PCBs and bulk oil for the past quarter of a century started catching on fire last night. Be that as it may, house cleaning continues. Next week, we'll be on vacation. We'll have a couple of new interviews for you, brief ones. But for members, you'll receive all sorts of material, both from this program, this incarnation of this program, and from Majority Report back in 2004 or five, a couple of interviews that I thought might be fun for you to hear, still relevant today. Of course, I guess it was on Tuesday. I guess I wasn't around yesterday to talk about it, but Gore Vidal passed on, and not all of his writings and positions over the years were necessarily well. His writing was always pretty. Not all of his positions were ones that I necessarily agreed with, but particularly in the years that I had the opportunity to interview him, his voice of dissent was booming. And so it's a big loss for those of us who appreciate a true and intelligent voice of dissent in this country. And next week for members, we will play a couple of interviews that we did with Gore Vidal. One, I think if I can locate it,
was where he was actually trying to convince Janine's father, Carmine, to not support George Bush, if I remember correctly. We were lucky enough to have Gore Vidal in the studio on multiple occasions, and always a great guest. And the, you know, I've started to comb back through these Majority Report archives, and God, it's unbelievable the interviews that we had and the opportunities we had to talk to people. And I wish I was a better interviewer then. I like to think that I'm better now. I may be deluding myself, but if you disagree, please, by all means, do not dispel me of that that delusion. It's important for me to grasp on tightly to those things. But we will play those, and you know, ultimately, we're going to make all of these archives available for members of the Majority Report, the Sam Cedar Show, the Cedar on Sunday program, and maybe even Break Room Live, if I can dig those babies up. So, anybody who's interested in any way in archiving these, many of them have been archived on samcedarshow.tv, but that site is not going to be around for too much longer. And so, you know, send us an email if this is something that you're into. If you're one of those people who like to organize things. And so we'll be off next week. Another programming note. If you are in New York City, WWRL will now be playing Ring of Fire, a triumphant return. To New York's progressive talk radio from 6 to 9 p.m. on Sundays. So that is personally exciting for me just because I love the idea of being on a New York radio. So if you are a New Yorker, you do occasionally or always listen to WWRL, send them an email and tell them how excited you are that Ring of Fire is going to be on Sundays, 6 to 9. I think the first one starts this weekend. And the show, of course, is co-hosted by myself and Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy. And great interviews. Pap and I get into it. A slightly different flavor than this program. Obviously, you can't have as long form of interviews. And but I always enjoy going the rounds with Pap. And so if you are in New York, check that out as well. And now we're going to go to this interview with Grant Greenwald. We're going to take a brief musical interlude. We had a little bit of technical difficulties with this interview. He, of course, lives in Brazil, and apparently their internet is occasionally spotty, not as if our internet isn't occasionally spotty as well. So forgive the little slight technical snafus and a change in the audio quality midway through when we had to move to a different and more archaic technology. This was actually smoke signals, but we had Matt translate them. All right, so I don't know why the implication is that you could see smoke signals from Brazil, but come on, folks. Give me a break. I'm already starting to think about vacation. And so we will be back after the interview. The number 646-257-3920. We'll be taking your calls, your IMs at Majority FM. And, of course, you can always, if you, regardless of your IM client, you can reach us at majorityfm@jabber.org. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Glenn Greenwald.
To let me know, should I stay or should I go?
All right, folks, this episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Our listeners, Majority Report listeners, can get a free Audible book right now, audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Go get a free audibly downloadable book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. You can pick up Neil Barofsky's book entitled Bailout, an inside account of how Washington abandoned Main Street while rescuing Wall Street. We just spoke to Neil. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Download your free audio book now.
You say that you are mine. I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine, the next is black. So
we are back on the Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program Glenn Greenwald. He blogs at, salon.com, but moving over to The Guardian UK, author of a multiple best-selling New York Times bestseller books. Welcome to the program, Glenn.
Thank you, Sam. Good to be here.
Intros are not always so easy.
I do this sometimes, and I know you can stumble over yourself, but I'm ready.
But that's part of my charm. Be that as it may, you wrote a piece the other day at Salon, Extremism Normalized. It's a great piece, and it really sort of tracks what is, it seems, has happened. Really, I mean, maybe this is eternal, but it certainly has been the pace of this seems to have increased over the years. You start with the example of the Patriot Act. Well, just tell us the overall idea here.
Well, the reason the Patriot Act is such a potent example illustrating this dynamic is because if you go back and read contemporaneous accounts from 2001 and 2002, when the Patriot Act was first enacted, what is so striking about it is that this was the period when basically everybody was on board with anything the government wanted to do because we were right in the aftermath of the post 9/11 trauma. And even in that hype period of supremely heightened fear and hysteria and sort of acquiescence to government authority, the Patriot Act was extremely controversial. I mean, in mainstream circles, not just, you know, the ACLU and the usual civil libertarian objectors, but in mainstream media circles and even within prominent, you know, political circles, you heard all kinds of alarmist rhetoric issuing about the Patriot Act. It sort of became the symbolic face of Bush-Cheney radicalism. It was, you know, kind of the warning bells that we might overreact to 9/11 by becoming too authoritarian, by eliminating and eroding the freedoms that we've long taken for granted. It was a very draconian piece of legislation that vested the government with all sorts of unprecedented powers of surveillance and detention. It got rid of safeguards that had existed for decades against abuse. And it was enacted very hastily, and barely anybody even knew what it said when they voted on it. It was really the kind of law that was held up as the sort of thing that was just extremism unleashed. And yet here we are more than a decade removed from 9/11. And the Patriot Act, you know, one of the things that happened when the Patriot Act was enacted was there was a provision put into it that said, look, we know what we're doing here is extremist and radical and a departure from how we typically operate as a government, but we think it's justified by the crisis of 9/11. So, but we want you to know this isn't going to be a permanent change. We're putting in a sunset provision that says this law will expire in 4 years unless it's renewed. So even then people knew that it was an extremist piece of legislation. And what has happened is that every 4 years, this law has been renewed without any controversy any longer. I mean, the votes in the Congress are something like 90-10. Both parties are fully on board with their renewal. Both presidential administrations, Bush and now Obama, demand its renewal without any reforms. And this is true even though there's all kinds of evidence that the powers of the Patriot Act have been abused in exactly the way that the original Warners feared it would. And now the Patriot Act is just something that never gets discussed anymore. It's not considered controversial. It's just blended in to our political culture. It's just something we now take for granted. And this, to me, shows how what is at one time a radical act and viewed as extremism ultimately becomes just normalized by lasting long enough and then just sort of blending into the woodwork.
Let's talk, because I want to talk about the general because I have some questions about that. How narrow that phenomena seems to sort of cut across a lot of different areas. But let's also just I want to talk about the McCain quote too, because that really is stunning. Dick Cheney criticized McCain for having chosen Palin as his running mate. And McCain came back, look, I respect the vice president. He and I had strong disagreements as to whether we should torture people or not. I don't think we should have. This is stunning on a bunch of different levels. I mean, putting aside from the fact that McCain really should have had a little asterisk there saying, like, I don't think that we should have allowed the military to torture. The CIA, I still allow for. The CIA to torture, but I don't think we should have had it. Torture should be reserved for the spooks as opposed to our military personnel. But the implications of this are pretty stunning. Just break it down for us. McCain is basically saying, well, this guy's a torturer, but he's still okay in my book.
Right. I mean, he's obviously, you know, McCain is sort of a hot-headed kind of guy. He doesn't react well to criticism. He's never, you know, liked Dick Cheney, at least for a long time, going back to criticisms that McCain voiced over Iraq. And of course, McCain was resentful at George Bush for a long time at for what Bush did in the 2000 primary. So there's a feud here. And obviously, McCain is really trying to sort of jab Cheney with this kind of piercing insult by calling him a torturer. So far, so good. That is what Cheney is. And the way that he prefaced it, which is by saying, look, I respect Dick Cheney, you know, obviously, this is a way that, you know, political elites and all kinds of other people preface insult. It's this insincere expression of respect. You know, it's like saying with all due respect, you know, you're a repulsive thief and you know, a heinous human being. It obviously
to be honest,
insincere.
To be fair, I think I tweeted someone something like that today. So I use that rhetorically.
Right. So, I get what it's saying. At the same time, you know, this idea of prefacing these kind of remarks of saying, I respect Dick Cheney, even though it's insincere, it's what it really is it's a kind of ritualistic acknowledgement that the person you're about to criticize is within the realm of political mainstream acceptability. So, you know, not everybody gets this insincere expression. If John McCain stood up on the floor and wanted to denounce, you know, Bradley Manning or Julian Assange, for example, or, you know, Assad, he wouldn't stand up and say, you know, with all due respect, and then go to criticize them, because those are not people within the realm of accepted mainstream power factions in Washington. And so even though it wasn't a sincere expression of respect, it still struck me as unbelievable that he was essentially in one breath calling Dick Cheney a torturer, but in the other saying, I still recognize and give him the respect of somebody who is and should be within the circle of what is a serious political figure. And that to me was just so unbelievable that you could call somebody a torturer, which is what McCain did and what used to be probably the most, you know, sort of extreme insult you could cast at somebody, and at the same time say, you know, but at the same time they are, you know, still one of us, a member of good standing of the Washington class. And this shows how torture has sort of, you know, just like the Patriot Act, it used to be that it was the ultimate Western taboo, and it has now become just a standard garden variety political disagreement. So you disagree with somebody on torture,
it doesn't mean
they're cast out of respectability.
Then that's the ultimate point. It's not even so much his rhetorical flourish as it is the fact that, like, hey, you've just sort of announced that there's a torturer in our midst. Why haven't you done anything about it? I mean, you know, why aren't you
calling for his imprisonment?
Right. Exactly.
You know, I mean, torture is a war crime.
Glenn.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I lost you there for a minute. So torture is a war crime, indeed. And also, why isn't there sort of a greater reaction in the press? Because you do have a John McCain is basically publicly calling Dick Cheney a criminal. And what is amazing is that we don't, the press doesn't make any issue of it. I mean, it's all just about this rhetorical flourish. You've got this guy, John McCain, who goes on to, who's important enough, apparently, to be the only guest who's allowed on weekend television, you know, on these news shows 3 out of 4 weeks of the month. And the fact that he has now basically said that Dick Cheney was torturing, and now we just move on. And I guess that's the point of the example.
Right. And there are related examples. I mean, I remember, you know, back in 2010, the White House proudly announced that President Obama had met with Condoleezza Rice to get her advice on a variety of national security issues. And the White House likes to do these things because it shows they're bipartisan and the like. And yet, you know, ABC News and other outlets confirm that Condoleezza Rice is the person who presided over the meetings in the White House in which the torture regime was choreographed.
So we got interrupted with some technical problems here. Essentially, the point is that ultimately is that particularly on this. Let's give one more example. And this is the Total Information Awareness Program versus what has been recently launched by the New York Police Department, the Domain Awareness System. Now, I remember this Total Information Awareness Program. It was TIPS, it was called at the time, right?
Right.
So it was TIPS at the time. And when this was introduced, which I think was around 2002, it was there was a huge outcry about it. And now you mentioned that the New York Police Department is launching something similar. And nothing.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is I think a lot of people forgot what the Total Information Awareness Program was all about. But here again, you know, this is something that was proposed in late 2002, early 2003, again, when we were very close to the peak of our post 9/11 hysteria and willingness to vest sort of whatever power the government wanted. And yet this is a program they kind of dredged up John Poindexter from wherever Washington sewers he was sort of swimming around, you know, kind of like the defense settle in Iran-Contra figure, the former admiral, to oversee what was intended to be this sort of comprehensive, all-seeing surveillance program that was going to basically collect all forms of electronic data on American citizens and create this what he called all-seeing eye that would be able basically to engage in a real-time surveillance of pretty much everybody. So you go to the bank, it records that. You go take out money from the ATM machine, it records that. You call your mother, it records that. You call somebody else, you email somebody. Everything gets recorded in this all-seeing comprehensive surveillance system. And even for that period of time, this was just too invasive, too extreme, and Congress actually refused to fund it. The controversy caused the program to end. And yet now we have the New York Department explicitly boasting about the fact that they are creating what they're now calling an all-seeing surveillance program aimed at what they call criminals and potential terrorists, whatever that means. I don't know what a potential terrorist is. It sounds like it's basically anybody. And there's very little controversy over this, even though the language of it and the substance of it is the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning. I hadn't even heard about it, but for your mention, and I followed up on the link, and it reads literally like almost like a story you would see in Fast Inc. or whatever it is. After saying domain awareness system combines several streams of information to track both criminals and potential terrorists, New York Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly says the city developed the software with Microsoft. I mean, you would imagine that Microsoft would be a little bit nervous about, like, oh, we're enabling this this thing. Let's just leave our names out of the press releases and all the press. But no, it just sounds like this is a great. We've just developed a great database management system that we're hoping we'll be able to. It is so. There doesn't even to be a perception of why this might be controversial at this point.
Well, what's really interesting, Sam, is, you know, think about, you know, sort of standard dystopian science fiction novels that depict this kind of unimaginable tyranny. I mean, one of the most, you know, sort of the well-known and the kind of classic example of that genre is 1984. And what made the tyranny of 1984 so frightening and terrifying was that there were monitors in every person's home constantly monitoring and recording and surveilling what every private citizen was doing. There was basically no activity beyond the reach of government's prying eyes. That was the principle that made it so alarming. Or if you look at what, you know, in sort of the real world, Americans have always viewed as kind of the expression, the most extreme expression of tyrannical terror, it would be the East German Stasi, which was the intelligence service, domestic intelligence service, that had files on almost every single citizen constantly recording what they were doing, whether there was evidence of their guilt or not. I mean, this principle that the government shouldn't be collecting information on us, let alone knowing virtually everything that we're doing, unless there's evidence that we're actually engaged in criminal activity that a court says justifies surveillance. I mean, that was the core principle embedded into the Constitution. That's what the Fourth Amendment is about in terms of requiring search warrants from a court that finds probable cause. And yet we've completely abandoned that. We now have this society where we acquiesce to the idea that governments can and should know everything that we're doing, regardless of whether there's evidence of our wrongdoing. And I think that's why the NYPD is so willing to boast publicly about it, and why Microsoft is willing to become associated with it, because it's become normalized.
And of course, you go on in the piece to talk about the capacity of drones to also provide this type of constant and incredibly granular type of surveillance. Now, is what's happening here I don't know if this is a distinct phenomenon. I mean, because we could also argue that this type of surveillance, this extremism, is not the only thing that has become normalized in this day and age. The idea of an extended period of 8.2% unemployment in even in the context in which we sort of undercount employment would have been, well, people would have considered that an emergency 10 years ago. And yet today it is, well, as long as, I mean, I sit with supposed liberal commentators who say, you know, really what's important, you know, people aren't going to freak out unless the job numbers start to really go south. But the job numbers are already south. We're in an emergency here. It seems like the new normal, I guess, is your sense that our society has changed in some way that we accept these new normals, or is that there is has there been some type of change in our capacity to imagine a different situation, or is this something the way it's always been? It's just that perhaps technological advances have sort of outpaced our capacity for outrage.
I think there are two aspects to it. One is, I think that when there are very individualized, discrete instances of elite corruption or failure, it's very easy to sort of focus on them, become outraged about them, and to demand that something be done. But when the elite failure and elite corruption is endemic, is just systematic and just all-consuming, It's very difficult to sort of demand that something be done, because it's very hard to think about what could be done to arrest these massive, radical, fundamental, you know, degradations in your political culture and your society. It's a much more difficult task to sort of wrap your head around it and just start to think about it in a clear way, and let alone to figure out what can be done. So I think part of it is just the mammothness of it, the way it pervades all of our elite institutions. We've seen it with the Iraq War, with Katrina, with the financial collapse, with so much of the last decade. It's not just, you know, the Roman Catholic Church. It's not just one institution here and there engaging in discrete problematic behavior. It's really, it's what Chris Hayes in his new book calls this crisis of authority, that all American institutions seem to be collapsing on themselves in a way that, you know, empires always have. But I think the other aspect of it is that one of the things that, you know, elites do whenever things seem to start to fall apart, is they start to look for ways to protect themselves and fortify their own power and to prevent threats to it. And I think one of the things that we've seen is, you know, this sort of excuse that the 9/11 attacks gave to the American government and to the people who own and control it was to paramilitarize our police forces, to import the kinds of terror tactics that we use against other foreign peoples when we're engaged in a war against them, against our own people, to unleash this massive amount of spending on militarization, increased penalties for minor crimes, to allow huge amounts of surveillance and detention powers to be vested in our government, so that there's really this serious intimidation factor that conveys to citizens, look, even if you are somebody who thinks that you can diagnose the problem and want to take action against it, the risk of your doing it is so great and the probability of your success is so small that it's just best that you accept your own helplessness, your own impotence, and just sort of hope that things don't go too poorly for you and there's really nothing else that you can or should do. And I think this kind of fear has been inculcated to a very significant extent in the American public. They fear the government. They fear authority. They fear what can be done to them, rightfully so, if they engage in meaningful dissent. And I think that has been a big part of this acquiescence as well.
I mean, we see that. We've seen that explicitly in terms of the way the police have been suppressing dissent via Occupy. I mean, you can't have a better example. I mean, if Occupy was the tip of the spear, as it were, then, you know, there's no better example of how that movement was pulled apart in many respects by the police, and both in terms of its direct ability to intimidate people and also to sort of redirect much of the focus of the Occupy movement from protesting what is wrong systemically in this country to having to deal with protesting and focusing on the suppression of that dissent.
Yeah, I know. I remember when I went on my book tour back in late October, early November of 2011, when the Occupy movement was really at its peak. I went around to a bunch of places, you know, in the country. I did a lot of radio talk shows with call-ins and the like. And I had so many people say to me things like, you know, because I was hailing the Occupy movement as this really important political development. And I had so many people saying things like, well, you know, I'm a woman who has a small baby. And so even though I support the Occupy movement so much, I'm afraid to actually go and participate. Or, you know, a man would say, I have a disability, I have a bad leg, and I don't feel like I can flee tear gas canisters or pepper spray, and then I'm going to be, you know, then I'm at too much risk of my physical safety. A lot of people were actually afraid to go and participate in those peaceful protests. I mean, assembling and petitioning the government is a core constitutional right. Lots of people were afraid to exercise that right because of the show of force. I mean, basically the police won. And, you know, one of the stories that has always struck me that I tell a lot is when I first wrote about WikiLeaks a couple of years ago before very many people had heard about it, I wrote about all the reasons why I thought it was such an important and promising tool of transparency, and I encouraged people to donate money to it by including, you know, links at the bottom of the piece I wrote to where you can send money via PayPal or bank wire. And I had dozens and dozens of people say to me, you know, in comment sections by email when I would go to other places and speak, you know, look, I support WikiLeaks, but I'm afraid that if I donate money to them, I'm going to end up on a government list somewhere or be accused of aiding and abetting a terrorist organization at some point. And so I won't donate money, even though I support them. This was a core First Amendment right. I mean, to donate money to a group whose political cause you support, which had never been accused of, let alone convicted of a crime, is a core liberty. And yet huge numbers of people have been intimidated out of doing it. And I think, you know, there's so many examples like that, but this climate of fear is really pervasive and I think causes people to sort of be paralyzed and to become passive and accepting of even the worst abuses.
How does this sort of this cycle end? I mean, in a non, you know, apocalyptic fashion. I mean, is there something that breaks this? I mean, I guess it just comes to the point where people have had enough. But it seems to me that it's less likely to happen in the context of our civil liberties and more from an economic perspective, which I think then would, you know, and then you run up with, then you run up. I mean, this is what's essentially happened in many respects with the Occupy movement, is that the failure to speak out when we were militarizing our police following 9/11, you know, with LRADs and body armors and tanks and whatnot, sort of ended up in some respects stifling the dissent about economic policies that were going on in this country. I mean, how do we?
Right. I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, people don't march into the street and cause massive amounts of unrest over abstract civil liberties violations, especially when there's a perception that those civil liberties violations are confined to a minority, you know, which in this case is Muslims. But the way in which these abuses are related to economic abuses and the plundering of elites and the like is that the civil liberties abuses are implemented as a safeguard on the part of the elite, as a weapon to shield themselves from the unrest that they not just think is possible, but think is inevitable from this economic anxiety. I mean, you know, policymakers and planners in the West look to all the protests and serious amounts of unrest, which are just at the beginning in places like, you know, Greece and Spain and Portugal and even London. And it's only a matter of time before that happens in the United States. I mean, we've seen some of it with the Tea Party movement and Occupy, and just the general extreme levels of anger and dissatisfaction with American institutions across the board. And so, you know, you've had instances in history where elites and people in power have sought to appease that kind of citizen anger by doing things like engaging in very public acts of charity or even the New Deal. You know, if you look at some historians, it wasn't like Franklin Roosevelt's age thought it was important to create a social safety net because it was morally imperative. It was because they were scared that if people didn't, you know, have some safeguard against extreme levels of privation, that they would then revolt. And you see some of this fear now. But, you know, if you look at what happened in the Arab Spring, I mean, power factions don't give up power unless they're forced to. And I do think that kind of social unrest, that kind of disruption, that kind of fear in the heart of elites will be necessary for any real change to happen.
Yeah, I mean, how likely do you perceive that here? I mean, my concern is that, you know, we're that the system is in this country is set up, and the expectations of people are set up in such a way that we are extremely vulnerable, and it seems to me more likely to be sort of to head towards the, you know, the boiling frog scenario rather than you know, some type of massive crash. I mean, it seems conceivable, of course, that we could have some type of like sort of financial catastrophe. But, you know, I think clearly what we've seen, at least from, you know, the this administration and probably the previous one, is that when faced with a crash, the key is just to sort of like make sure there's just no crash. And maybe even take advantage of the new normal, which is going to sort of make the dynamic between what is a crash in the future and what the baseline was, you know, that much less extreme. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good point. But I think that, you know, the kind of change that we're talking about is not an either or sort of situation where either you accept the status quo as, you know, the frog in the boiling water before you, you know, before you realize it's happening, it's too late, or some kind of massive, you know, violent revolution. I think there's a continuum. So that if, for example, you know, the level of poverty in the United States, an extreme level of poverty where people literally have no faith in the prospects for the future and the belief that their children can actually build a better life, but there's virtually no cost mobility, the kind of poverty that we've seen, you know, and what has always been characterized as sort of the third world. If those kinds of trends continue, then, you know, there was a New York article in New York Magazine profiling this billionaire, Jeff Green, who's this horrible human being. But one of the things he was saying was, you know, he's trying to get his fellow oligarchs to realize the virtues of paying some more taxes so that you create better social safety nets, because what he's saying is, if we continue to create this class of huge numbers of poor people, you know, they're not going to be voting any longer for a Romney or for an Obama. They're going to vote for a Hugo Chavez, you know, what he thinks of as a Hugo Chavez. But there's going to be sort of radical changes, even if it's through the electoral system, the rise of, you know, third parties like you see in Greece, where the far right and the far left are both attracting far more support than they've ever attracted before. So, you know, if you put people in an intense enough state of deprivation and take away enough hope that things can actually get better for them and instill in them this sense of anger and betrayal at the unfairness of the society, you know, history proves that they're going to do something, whether it's effective or not, whether it's radical or incremental. Those are all, you know, dependent upon lots of factors. But there's going to be a reaction. And I think that our elite class is starting to fear that a little bit, probably not as much as they should or it would be good for them to. But I think you can see lots of different outcomes beyond, you know, beyond just everyone's going to suddenly take to the street with arms and you know, seize the mechanisms of labor and production.
Yes. Well, I guess we'll see. The point remains is just sort of how there just seems to be a numbness amongst the American public, and I wonder to a certain extent, you know, there also seems and I know you're pressed for time, so we just got. But I just want to throw this idea out as well, that on some level the mechanism for dissent, at least within the context of the system, was always sort of represented by these two political parties, and it seems like they're not functioning at all. I mean, in the sense that theoretically you might look to the Democrats to have a problem. I mean, theoretically, with things like the Patriot Act or even, I guess, you know, some libertarian strains on the right. And it seems that, like, all the quarters where one would hear dissent about what is going on have been neutralized and sort of absorbed into some a big middle. I mean, you know, I just yesterday it has been sort of, I guess, selectively leaked by the Obama administration that we are now engaged in some type of arming of one side of this growing Syrian civil war, and the idea that the Obama administration perceives this as valuable, and I assume it's, you know, I read it as a political calculation, is sort of fascinating, because there doesn't seem to be anybody who is going to speak up about this being problematic in any way. I mean, it doesn't seem there's going to be any debate about this once a way or another. And it's indicative of the muting of voices that are traditionally dissenting about these things.
Right. I mean, clearly both political parties are serving the same interest. They have some marginal and symbolic differences on a lot of issues. They have real differences on a few issues, mostly of a social and cultural nature. But when it comes to economic policy and especially national security and terrorism and civil liberties issues, there's very little difference between the two. And I think one of the things that the outcome of that, you know, it's not just people like you and me who realize that. I mean, Barack Obama, when he was running for president, talked continuously about what he called the widespread pervasive cynicism in the American citizenry, the idea that it doesn't matter who they vote for, it doesn't matter who wins elections, the same forces in Washington continue to have their way. And the reason there was such energy behind his candidacy was not because of any specific policy position that he took, but it was because of the vow that he was going to change that. And, you know, just yesterday there were leaked emails or published emails by one of his top aides in the White House who was meeting with representatives of pharma during the entire healthcare negotiation in secret, you know, purposely meeting in diners so that they could avoid detection by not having the names on the White House list. using his personal email account to communicate, that it would be subject to preservation and disclosure requirements. You know, this whole healthcare bill was basically drafted with secret meetings by the very industry lobbyists who the Obama campaign had vowed to combat. And this, you see, replicating itself in virtually every realm, where it doesn't matter what the outcome of the election is, the same interests are served. And what I think that does is, it would be one thing if only people who pay close attention to politics realize that. But for a long time, you know, the idea that we select our leaders and that we can therefore choose what policies our government pursues was an important means of placating the American citizenry into accepting all sorts of abuses by believing that we're at least free and sovereign and have self-determination. Once people start giving up on the political electoral process as a means of viable change, which people increasingly are, then that's when the prospect of more radical movements, I think, becomes viable. And in the way that you asked me earlier, do I think it's possible? I think, you know, for a long time, the electoral process co-opted lots of political energy. The more people start believing that political process doesn't offer any real hope of change, the more they're going to look for alternatives. That can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing. But it's something that, you know, is likely to produce more extreme outcomes one way or the other.
Glenn Greenwald, when are you moving over to The Guardian?
August 20th is my first day starting there.
Okay, so Glenn Greenwald with Salon.com, soon to be at The Guardian. Congratulations on that new gig, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. Always a pleasure.
All right, folks. Coming up in the better half of the program, we're going to dig into Mitt Romney's double down on the culture of the Palestinians and how it's all about freedom. Except for in the case of the Palestinians who don't have the freedom. I mean, it's a pretty nuanced piece, folks. So you're going to have to hang in there. Also, a rogue algorithm joins the rogue traders in exposing how much our financial markets are BS. The Affordable Care Act today actually provides more preventative health care for free, with no copays. We will talk about that in the program. Story of a couple of immigration activists, young people, who got themselves put into I believe are still there, essentially into a jail in Florida to expose what's going on with immigrants. And a great piece yesterday apparently was National Hate a Gay, Eat a Piece of Processed Chicken Day, or something like that, right? What was the official title of it?
Chick-fil-A Appreciation Day.
Yeah, okay. Six of one, half dozen the other. And a really fascinating piece by an employee of Chick-fil-A who is, as far as I can tell, she works there and is gay herself. Lesbian, and interesting piece. We will talk about that. And then, of course, a tiny bit of news that, of course, warms the cackles of my heart. Here's a little hint. Longtime listeners will know what this story is about, and you can listen to it in the better half of the program. If you're a member. And let me just say, you know, I'm not whining here, and maybe I'm a little bit defensive about it, but and I certainly am more sensitive than to listener feedback. Not that I was, I would ignore listener feedback back when I was doing radio, but I'm more sensitive to it now. Someone sent in an email and said, you know, I'm not going to be a member anymore because you took Wednesday off, and next week you're not going to be here. You don't have a fill-in, and I can certainly appreciate there are people who are on tight budgets, and if you can't afford to pay for the program, I've said many times, and the offer still stands, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll work something out. I don't want anybody to be excluded from the the better half of the program because of financial reasons. But understand that this is not a podcast of a radio show. The only source of revenue that we have on this program, for all intents and purposes, you know, we get a couple hundred bucks on a good month from Google with our YouTubes, and, you know, some months are better than other with the Just Coffee and Amazon links, and I don't know, buddy, merch is actually, we're in the, well, one of the problems with my business acumen is I don't even know if I want to be in the black or the red when it comes to the merchandise. But nevertheless, the point is, this is, you know, don't email me and compare what we pay, what you pay for this show with other shows that you may pay, because the fact is we have a different business model. And I will say again, I will put up our content against any other content that is out there. We don't have the resources that other shows have, really any other shows. And but on this program, we bring in interviews with writers and authors and thinkers and activists, and interview them in just in terms of length. I don't know. I mean, you can decide whether or not you think that I'm a quality interviewer, but we provide a forum that really is not available just about anywhere else, and certainly not available anywhere else with both the combination of caliber of guests and of specific political perspective that you don't get. Charlie Rose, yes, he does long-form interviews. But I think that probably the scope of the guests that we have is a little bit broader, particularly on one end of the ideological spectrum.
Just this past week alone, in a row, our shows have had Glenn Greenwald, Neil Barofsky, Elliot Spitzer, Cliff Schechter, Matt Taibbi, in a row.
Yes. In other words, we need to get more female guests, and I appreciate
that.
Well,
then right before that was the show where we didn't have a guest, and you had an extended news, and then before that was Digby, so...
Well, even still. But, and, you know, frankly, over the course of the summer, it's very difficult to get guests. People just aren't as available. So we're going to have a couple of quick interviews for the freeloaders next week. And we're going to dig into the archives. It should be interesting material. But, you know, understand, we put out – today is, I don't know, our 451st show in a year and a half. And we've done probably at least 450 interviews. Are they all great? No, I would say probably 442 of them are great. I'm sure there's a bad, you know, 9 or 10 interviews. But so, you know, if you're having financial problems or you can't justify the expense, you know, I get that. But, you know, the comparison is what I guess sort of annoys me. And, you know, if I have another job that's paying me an enormous amount of money, we may be in a position to knock down the price of the podcast or make the whole thing free. I don't know. And certainly and beef up the staff and whatnot. But, you know, the reality is that some of the positions I take on this show shut some doors. And that's fine. I'm not crying about that. That's the nature of nature of life. And now I'm going to do the rest of the show in a sort of a Midrashic accent. So, folks, also, if you can become a member at majority.fm, please do. It's certainly worth your while next week. To get some archived material that will not be available to anyone else. But also, even if you don't listen to the full show, you know, you're supporting the first 40 minutes. And, you know, people have told me you have to offer less. Cut the interviews off in the middle. And frankly, I don't think the guests would necessarily have a problem with that. I imagine some would, but the audience is substantial enough on the other side of the paywall, and people enjoy the interviews. But I want to expand the reach of the program as much as possible, because frankly, a part of the reason why I do this, a big part, and I don't know if it's 65% or 70% of the reason why I do this, is because trying to have some even tiny impact in promoting certain ideas and a certain political perspective. And I have no illusion as to the impact I'm going to have in a broader discourse unless you people go out and echo those sentiments. You know, this is not like the days when the Majority Report was on, you know, 60 stations nationwide in New York and in L.A. and in Chicago and in New Orleans and in Philadelphia, not reaching that many people. But the flip side is we're able to do something that's a little bit more deeper and a little bit more intelligent, frankly. Sometimes it gets a little weedy. So become a member today, majority.fm. If you can, there are other ways to support the show. You can go to majority.fm/support the show. We've got Just Coffee. Somebody emailed me the other day, said, I don't know what Mark Maron's talking about. The WTF blend stinks, which I find hard to believe because I've never had a product from Just Coffee that I didn't like, but maybe it's his personal taste. But he bought a 5-pound bag of the Majority FM blend. With a 10% discount coupon.
For a second, I thought you were going to say nothing. Majority. For a second, I thought you were going to say nothing Mark Maron does stinks. And I was about to say, that's not very Sam Cedar of you.
No, no. I am a big fan of Mark Maron's work. And he knows that, and everybody knows that. I can tell you that, like, just physically, not the sweetest smelling guy. I mean, I think that came out on Break Room Live. The guy he likes to put on certain like body oils, and I don't, it's not for me. I have an allergic reaction to it. But aside from that, when I say Mark, if I ever say Mark Maron stinks, understand I'm being literal. All right, folks, see you in the better half, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. He knows I have a problem with all that stuff he supposedly showers himself with, and by no means am I the most hygienic person. I consider myself probably on the less hygienic end of the spectrum, particularly when I don't have to do TV. Oh, last night I was on Spitzer, but then I go home. I don't have to do afternoon TV. Forget about it. And you know, sometimes he just doesn't. You know, whatever. Different strokes for different folks, but, you know, the nose knows. All right, 646-257-3920. The IM is Majority FM. You can also IM me at majorityfm@jabber.org. See you on the better half.